So we will move on to the section in our book called The Religious Spirit. Mizuno brings up some interesting ideas in this section, this chapter. Starting off with the idea of what I would refer to as bodhicitta, what Dogen refers to as the mind that seeks the way. Buddhism in the West, Buddhism in America today, is practiced predominantly by, as practiced by Westerners, is practiced predominantly by people who have come to practice looking for something. In contrast to an established religious practice where you come to practice because that's what your family did or that's what your social group does or whatever. So in Asian countries, or even ethnic Buddhist temples in this country, you go to the temple and there's whole families that go, and you know, people are bringing their little kids along, and it's a kind of a cultural thing. I have no problem with that practice, and it's quite effective. People in that situation practice because it's what they're familiar with, and then if they feel so inclined, they may take it to a deeper level. Most of us Westerners come to practice because we're looking for something, or something has shifted in our mind, something has shifted in our experience, which makes us think there must be something more, there must be something, I'm suffering and I need to do something about my suffering. And this thing which leads us to, this impulse which leads us to religious practice, or leads us to consider the possibility of religious practice, is what we call bodhicitta, or the mind that seeks the way. And it's really useful to, I find it to my, for myself to be really useful to be aware that that is functioning within us. The word bodhicitta, translated from the Sanskrit, means, bodhi means enlightenment, and citta means mind. So it's the mind that seeks the way, or the mind of enlightenment. And that mind that seeks the way arises in different ways for each of us. And in this chapter, he describes it, although he doesn't use the term, he describes different people's experience of coming to religion. Some might come because, one monk I know, one of the masters I know, said she came to practice and came to being a monk because she wanted to get smarter. We all come for different reasons. We want to get smarter, we want to be nicer, we want to be whatever, we want to get something from practice. This is all fine and the critical thing is to allow the impulse which brings us to religion to be to remain, while the thing which we've come for may drop away. I mean, it might be that we decided we're coming to awaken to the truth and become enlightened, whatever that means. And even that will end up falling away. And the thing that is left is this impulse to practice, this impulse to train. It's worthwhile to recognize that is functioning in our life, because that is a kind of foundation for our religious practice, and it is something that we, which is in a sense alive within us. It is. Buddha nature, in fact. Bodhicitta is the arising of Buddha nature. It's kind of like Buddha nature beckoning to itself, arising in our minds, whether we see that or not. So, in a way, the religious spirit is that, and again, I said this before and in this series of talks, the word religion means to relink, to reconnect. And that spirit which leads us to practice is, again, bodhicitta. And that spirit that we awaken to is bodhicitta. In the last chapter, in the last talk, we talked a bit about faith and doubt. Faith in practice, faith as the stepping into the unknown and being willing to learn. In a way, that faith, and the reason that bodhicitta is important is because that faith is rooted in our own bodhicitta, our own experience of bodhicitta. Our faith is really saying, I have faith in my own feeling that there is something more. I have faith in my own sense that there is a purpose for religious practice. There is a purpose for this spirit, this impulse to really reconnect with what is really deeply true. Faith, trust, truth. These are all, actually, I was just looking it up in the dictionary, they all have common, have a common root. The word true means to be faithful, in a sense. That's the kind of Middle English kind of root of the word. We're looking for truth. We're looking for truth. And we're looking for, in a sense, the real. Again, one of the ideas that he talks about in this chapter is the idea that people who practice, part of the, who come to religion in the way that I'm talking about in this particular context, come because of the experience of reality. They come because of the experience of life as it is, not as we wish it to be or as we hope it will be. Because we begin to experience, awaken to life as it is with all its complexity and pain, suffering, joy, sorrow, all of that. So we've come because we kind of get a glimpse of what's true in life, what's really the kind of true nature of life. And because it's only a glimpse, we think, well, there must be something more. I think I've said this before. It used to be kind of striking to me. There was a certain period where it was popular to say, get real to someone. You know, which usually means, wake up to the unpleasant reality that you're wrong. That's a useful kind of phrase and a useful kind of state to be in. But the thing that was striking to me at one point was how the reality of life actually contains more than the consequence of suffering for wrong actions, which is kind of what that idea is pointing at. To get real in life is also to find truth, to find compassion, love, and wisdom, to find Buddha nature, to find peace of mind within the nature of life. So there's a way in which we wake up to reality, but part of us is seeing the unpleasant side of reality, and at the same time, in a way, bodhicitta is saying, there's more to the picture than meets the eye. There's more going on here than we see, and you can find that. In other words, how do I live with the reality of life in a peaceful way? Now, this chapter talks about coming to religion, and it talks about it in a fairly somewhat Sunday school kind of way. It talks about what are called the four indestructible objects of faith. Those four indestructible objects of faith are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and the precepts. And the thing I was looking for is how he exactly phrased this next part, which is that he talks about them, and the way that he talks about them in a Sunday school way is that he talks about the Buddha as a perfect being who we can have absolute trust in, and the Sangha in the same way. And in a way, that is true, that is literally true. But, and as we go more deeply into it, we need to understand that they, that those things, that those four indestructible objects of faith exist in the real world, exist in the world that has negative consequences. And so when we see the Buddha, I have no doubt that he realized perfect enlightenment. He had perfect awareness of his own propensity for creating suffering. He had a perfect ability to keep himself from creating suffering or perpetuating himself in terms of rebirth. He was still a human being and had limited view because of that. He made mistakes, in other words. The reason I would say that this chapter talks about the four indestructible objects of faith as a little bit Sunday school is because, and he actually even admits this, is because it doesn't incorporate that part of the reality of life, that suffering exists. Suffering existed for the Buddha. You know, he had headaches, people threw rocks at him, he received the consequences of former negative actions, he made mistakes which led to the suffering of other people. Of course, the suffering of those people had a lot to do with their own mistakes, but he was unable to predict the event that I'm talking about is that he had a number of disciples, I think 50 disciples, who he was teaching, and he gave them the loathsomeness of the body to contemplate. It's a fairly common mode of meditation for monks. You kind of go through and look at how your body is basically decomposing as you sit there, and contemplate why that's so. Contemplate the excrement that's moving through your body, the pus that comes out of, you know, things. Basically kind of trying to get you to say, maybe our idealized view of the body isn't quite true, because it's really kind of gross, effectively. Well, these monks took that a little bit too seriously. They thought, oh my God, look how loathsome this body is, and they all decided they would commit suicide. So they did. So 50 monks commit suicide because they thought their bodies were too loathsome. Now, this was not the Buddha's fault. I mean, these guys did this thing. But one could argue maybe he should have seen that they were of a state to take this teaching to extreme. Maybe it was a mistake, maybe it wasn't. Ambiguous, anyway. My point isn't to point the finger at the Buddha or cause a doubt, but to say that our faith, our trust in the four indestructible objects, our faith, our trust in our own bodhicitta, needs to encompass the existence of suffering, the reality of the negative consequences of action. Doubt arises because doubt is effectively the effect of discriminatory thinking, basically. It's the effect of thinking either one thing has to be true or another thing has to be true. Two things can't mutually exist at the same time. A Buddha can't be a Buddha and be an imperfect human being. But the reality of life is that when you let go of discrimination about it, there is no conflict. There is no problem with a Buddha being a human being who can make mistakes, who has limitations. There really isn't. So, as we go along in practice, we give our devotion to practice. In a sense, we're giving our devotion to our own aspiration. We're giving our devotion to bodhicitta, which is arising in our minds. Giving our devotion to the mind that seeks the way that arises in our hearts, with the knowledge that there is something deeper. There is something deeper than the surface reality, the surface consequence, the surface negative consequence. the surface positive consequence. And this is what we call this devotion to this, to practice, is what we call a religious spirit. It is also true that we start where we start. We are what we are. We start where we start. And the nice thing about practice is that it allows us to go forward and build a foundation, build a practice. We don't have to kind of make one grand gesture and we're there or whatever. We go along and we prove in a way practice true for ourselves. We prove it true by putting the teaching into practice as we come to it and see this, you know, we encounter some teaching and we think, oh, that would be a good thing to put into practice now. I will try that. And by trying it, then we prove it true for ourselves. So practice, again, is always experiential. The idea of living in faith is not blind faith. It's not faith based on belief. It's faith based on our experience of putting the teaching into practice. So no one needs to demand our faith or our trust. We just gradually begin to give our faith and trust and devotion to practice. It's our kind of voluntary action. And we, again, prove it true through our own experience. I think that's the gist of what I want to say tonight. Any questions?
I'll just make one comment and question, because I've often struggled with the whole issue of faith, and I was very interested to hear your description of faith there. I've often been bothered at times when I have seen faith used in the sense that people are asked to believe in things they can't understand. But that concept of faith to me is very different from what you're describing when you connected it with faith born out of your experience and practice. So, I mean, on one hand, faith has almost been superstitious in nature,
yes,
and even political at times. But this is very different and much more encouraging to me if I'm understanding what you're describing.
Yeah. In Buddhism, no, we don't need to believe in a particular thing in order to be expressive of our faith. There is a quality at times where someone says something within the context of practice and you think, oh, that doesn't make immediate sense to me, but maybe it would be good to try it. And in that sense, we're stepping off into the unknown. But we're not asked to affirm faith about that. We're asked to potentially step off into the unknown and test something. Test a principle, test a teaching. So an example of this might be we might be super critical of other people or whatever. And a teacher might say to you, you might try not being so critical. And I'm not thinking about you in particular, or anybody in particular. Actually, I'm thinking about myself. And what that means is, I mean, there's a way that you can present that and say, if you really have faith, you won't be so critical. But I think what I've encountered more in practice is, give it a try. Give it a try. See what happens if you're not so critical. See what happens if you let go of that critical mind. See what happens if you trust more. And prove it true for yourself. And in that way, we learn something new. Again, I've kind of said this a number of times, we'll probably say it a number of times because I need to remind myself of it. We come to practice looking for something. We come to practice because we think there must be more in life. And that means we're kind of, we don't really like to admit this, but we're kind of tacitly saying, I don't know everything. I'm going to try to find something new. I'm going to try to find a different way of being or a new way of being. And that means, in a way, doing things differently. So we come to practice, and practice may challenge us in some way, challenge some kind of belief that we have. And you can say, well, I don't believe that, and go away. Or you can say, I've come to practice to learn something new. Maybe this is one of the places where I'm obscuring my ability to see this new thing. And if I stopped doing X, Y, or Z behavior, I might be able to see that new thing which I've come to learn. Does this make sense? So, like, with my own propensity for criticism, criticism really works well for me. You know, my discriminatory mind has worked well for me over the years. And it kind of gets the job done. But I have this arise, this kind of thing arising in me saying there must be more in life. And what the Dharma is saying is, well, criticism, that kind of discriminatory mind, is an obstacle to what it is that your impulse wants to find. Okay? And so maybe, you know, the Dharma is saying, teachers are saying, maybe you need to let go of that critical mind. Or at least give that a try. And that process of letting go of a critical mind is a process of faith. Now that faith is what I'm talking about, where the faith is in me. It is really in me. It's really in my both potential ability to kind of learn this new thing. It's faith in my impulse to find that bigger thing. And it's also faith in my intuitive, it's hard for me to describe, like with the Buddha. I just have this intuitive feeling the Buddha's not lying to me. He's not just making this up. You know, he wasn't this guy who just had a big ego and thought, okay, I'm going to come up with this neat system and people will follow me. He's actually talking about something which is true. I may not kind of understand it, but somehow there's this intuitive sense that what the Buddha is talking about is true. And people, other teachers that I've met, oh, I have this intuitive sense what they're saying is true. After I get to know them a little bit, I might think, oh, I wonder if they really kind of know what they're talking about. But there is that intuitive recognition. There's some kind of truth here, which I'm not able to quite grasp, but I kind of want to know more about. So it's trust in that intuition that there's something real going on here that makes me consider the possibility that I might actually benefit from setting aside my critical mind. And then I need to take that step in faith. So what I'm trying to say, though, is that no, you don't have to believe in any particular thing. It's not based on any kind of doctrinal statement. There's no Nicene Creed or whatever that we have to believe in. It's just more a matter of, as a stepwise practice, we often find ourselves stepping off into the unknown. And in that sense, there's a quality of faith in that. Now, as it turns out, in terms of meditation practice, that stepping into the unknown is actually sort of where I've come to understand myself to live, where I'm just constantly stepping into letting go of what's going on in my mind. Now, I may more or less successfully do that, but that's kind of right at the heart of living by meditation. It's just stepping into this kind of not know, place of not knowing, and being willing to just be there and see how that works out. You know, it's actually kind of all right most of the time. Something shifts and changes, or there's some kind of creativity in that place. And in a way, that's living the life of faith.
I don't know if this is adding anything, but the faith that we talk about in Buddhism is very soft. It's not hard. It's not opposed to anything. It's not judgmental. It's not discriminatory. It supports our practice. It doesn't have a lot to do with belief. Does that make any sense?
It does.
And it's basically there to help us to take that step into the unknown, rather than to try to get us to do something with our minds, in the sense of make ourselves believe something that we don't believe, or something like that. I'm not sure that's kind of not very well said. I'm not quite sure how to express it. It's there to help us to practice, to actually do something about ourselves, rather than to say some way we think the world ought to be. Doesn't matter how the world is, in a sense. It's just we accept it, however it is. And it's that very, it's the faith that helps us with that very acceptance. And it's what makes Buddhism a religion. That faith underlies the whole thing. Without that faith, practice could be very, very dark at times, although it is anyway, and the faith is what supports us.
So I guess, like you said, like most people come to Buddhism with, I guess it's stronger than a curiosity, but a searching for truth. And then you have this experience, and then it's kind of a cycle between faith and experience, where they reinforce one another, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just the question is, we come seeking the truth. How has your experience of the truth deepened as you've deepened your practice, or as you've, I don't know if that question makes sense, but how has it evolved or changed? Or
I don't think that, let's see. My, I'm not trying to be cute when I say this. In one way, the truth that has not really changed, and in a way my life has not really changed since I started practicing, although in another way it kind of has radically changed. In a way, it's just, well, Master Hario had this great analogy. He said training is sort of like you have this brick building, two or three stories, you know, standard brick building with doors and windows and all the sort of stuff. And the process of training basically is removing the mortar from the bricks. Mm. The building still stands there, it still looks the same, but it doesn't have any more mortar in the bricks. Mm. And all this light can get through. And it, the more I train, the more my life is sort of like that, where it's just not as kind of solid as it once was. And my awareness of that has definitely kind of grown. And my appreciation of the value of having a brick building that doesn't have any mortar in it has definitely deepened. But in a way, my person still looks pretty much like that brick building, just doesn't have any, as much mortar in it, I should say. Can't really say all mortar's gone yet. So both things are happening at the same time. My life is changing radically, but it's also not. It's just becoming more porous. Does that make some sense? And does that answer the
question? Well, it definitely does.
It's kind of very, like, I'm thinking about it right now, I'm thinking how great that is. I don't have to, I started off in practice, and there's a kind of really important part of practice, which I alluded to before, which is the willingness to be and do things differently in my life. To be different if that's necessary, to do things differently if that's necessary. To really, this willingness to be a different person if the person that I am being is I discover to be contrary to practice or the truth. So if part of my being, what I mean by this is, if part of my being is, great thrill in robbing banks, at some point I'm going to come to realize, that's stealing, I'm going to have to stop that. I'm going to have to give up that part of my identity, the bank robber identity. And so from the beginning, my commitment has been to look at my life and to let go of those things which are contrary to the truth. But I really like being a bank robber, so that's going to be hard. And maybe part of the thing is I'm going to think, it's not worth it. I want to be a bank robber, so I'm going to keep going, or, something like that. There's going to be this kind of push shove. But eventually, if I continue to be devoted and faithful in my impulse to train, I'm going to let that go. And in that sense, I'm willing to become a different person. But in another way, my basic character, the thing that people would recognize as William, my name, people still recognize me as that. I write to my aunt and uncle and they still recognize me. They say, you look like your dad, or whatever. Friends still recognize my dopey sense of humor, or whatever. And so there's this kind of great relief inwardly that there isn't, I'm not required to be kind of fundamentally different than my character is. I'm not required to go against anything that's really real or fundamental about me, even though I am willing to do that if that's necessary. Does that make sense? So there's a kind of comfort in that.
So is the porousness kind of defined by self, your ability for a greater sense of self-awareness in light of the fundamental truths that you've, if that makes sense? Like the bank, bank robber analogy, I guess, is the one that made me think of that. But
I think that porousness comes with the experience of letting go of stuff like being the bank robber. I've never robbed a bank. I really know anything about robbing banks or anything like that. I've never taken pleasure in stealing anything, so that was just a fiction. Just to get that stated publicly. But the porousness comes from the experience of going through the process of letting go of stuff like that and realizing, oh, that wasn't me anyway. That wasn't who I am fundamentally. And that quality of letting go just allows a lot of air in there. Because a lot of the stuff that I thought was me really wasn't me. I'm thinking the glue that's holding together is me, but really it's not. And so that's where it comes from. Is that me?
No, not yet.
Okay.
Part of finding the truth as you go on, for me, has been stopping worrying about it. Stopping, in a sense, looking for it. And just getting on with it, doing whatever needs to be done. I thought the truth would be something I would know. It would be this graspable knowledge. If that's what it is, I don't have a clue. I really don't have a clue. But I feel a lot more grateful. I feel a lot more happy, I guess. I feel a lot more purposeful. On one level, I really know what I'm doing now, although I would find that kind of hard to put in. I mean, I guess in the sense I know what I'm doing in the sense of keeping the precepts in training. I mean, it makes sense. You know, it's not a bunch of beliefs or rules. It's what I want to do. It's not even what I want to do, it's just what I do. So I don't think that much about quote unquote the truth anymore.
There's a kind of contentment that arises with just my life as it is. It's not like because there's a way that we think about the truth as something I'll get fixed the way that I am. But the truth of the matter is, the way that I am, if I can actually sit still in it, is just okay. I can train in it. It doesn't, you know, it's kind of a wonky looking building. It doesn't, you know, may not. Got a little bit of a leak up there, and that kind of gable end doesn't really lead anywhere, and you know, that sort of stuff. But so what? You know, it's functional. I can be content.
It seems that the people that are most familiar with the truth, there's a certain sense of a firmness and drive, you know, towards that. But then there's also defined by this like extremely powerful lightness to their action and to the way they live. I don't know if that makes sense. That's, I find, I guess, really cool.
I don't find much lightness about anything I do or say, so I'm not saying I'm enlightened, and so there, I don't experience that. I just sort of...
Well, in a sense of... lightness towards their ability to let things go, basically. Lightness to it.
There's an interesting thing I noticed. I had this friend in Mount Shasta who's not a monk, who was a monk anyway, she lived in the monastic community for a while, but then wasn't living in the monastic community. We'd have these monks retreats, and the end of the monks retreat would come. The monastery would close. You have this monks retreat, and the end of the retreat would come. All the monks are kind of walking around half dead because they're pretty physically exhausting. She'd come and just like, oh, you guys are all so light, you know, like radiant. And I'm thinking, you know, just get me to bed. There's a quality of practice. I don't think of myself as being, well, I really don't think of myself as being enlightened. Someone else may be able to see the result of practice in me, and or may not. I don't know. I'm not don't want to claim anything, but this is just. But my experience isn't. I'm not like. And I think this is what our master's trying to say is we're not like walking around on a cloud all the time. We're just kind of living. And there may be that quality of lightness about us, but it's not really something that you're kind of conscious of. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so I just, you know, I hear your description. I think I just have to bow and say, oh yeah, I've seen that in other people. if you know what I mean. And it's not to be discounted. When we encounter Buddha nature, we see Buddha nature in however form that we see it, that is in a way a gift to us. And we should not doubt that we can actually give expression to that thing. And that it is part of what we can do just as we are in our own life, and we may not be aware of it. I had this kind of powerful experience once of having this person come and like thinking, my God, this person's like a Buddha, and they had no, you know, I know I could see in interacting with them, they had no idea that was true. It was kind of weird, but nevertheless, very interesting. And like in my case, it's probably a good thing. If I thought, oh, now I'm giving expression to it, you know, the old brain would just kind of go, wow. Okay. Well, thank you.